to embarrass people, especially when I'm teaching, like in school, if I can point out a student or something that's unusual, just like to put them on the spot. So I like to put somebody on the spot. There is a young lady here who I baptized back in 1987. I was 2 years a priest. First baptism in Nebraska. Jacinta, why don't you stand up there? I was going to say that the theme of the conference, the servant of Mary shall never perish, that wasn't absolutely going to be the theme. You know, in January, we kind of speak to the priest about the theme, and we had some ideas, and one of the themes was our life, our sweetness, and our hope from the Hail Holy Queen. And then those two ideas were going back and forth. And then I think Sister thought, okay, this is it. So she put it down, and okay, that's what we're going to do. So I wanted to take for the title of my lecture, Our Life, Our Sweetness, and Our Hope. And there's a reason for that. Wherever I go, there is anxiety. There is worry about the future. And it's not just the United States. It's also in Europe. I was with Father Borja in Europe. We were having confirmations, which we were going to be having confirmations about a year and a half ago. Then COVID came and we couldn't travel there. But I needed to use up my ticket before it expired. And they said they're going to open up Europe as long as you had a test for the COVID before you come into Europe, you're okay. But I remember when we came to Italy, we arrived in just north of Venice, Treviso, where Father Amirhamovich is, and it's pretty late at night. It's like 11:20, and there was quite a few of his faithful there, and they wanted to talk to me. And Father Amirhamovich was saying, you know, the bishop's tired, and he's this, and I said, Father, if they waited for hours, I'm not going to turn them down. No problem, happy to talk to them, etc. But people are concerned about the future. Where are all these things heading? What's happening? Things don't make any sense. We're being lied to. And I'd like to begin by telling you that this is not a conspiracy theory, but I remember seeing a little blurb of Dr. Fauci long before the COVID even hit. I think it was like 2017. And I know who he is talking to, but Dr. Fauci said, during this administration, this presidency, we're going to be hitting a pandemic. I thought, is this guy a prophet? No. Is he holy? No. But he knew something. I don't think that this whole COVID thing was planned. I mean, was not planned. I think it was very definitely planned. Now, how would Dr. Fauci know that a pandemic was going to come? Is he speculating? No, he wasn't saying it might or it could. It is. And we know the ramifications of what's all occurred. But there's so many things happening. We select start in our country and then go out of the country. But what's happening in our country? Our country is being destroyed from within. We have an open border. Illegal people are coming in by the thousands, hundreds of thousands. And for all of the concern about the COVID and you got to get vaccinated, everybody, and you got to keep your distance and wear a mask and do this and that, there is no concern about these people coming across the border who are not vaccinated. We're not just talking about the COVID vaccination. We're talking about measles, rubella, any of that other vaccinations that maybe a lot of us had received when we were infants. There's no concern for that. They come through the country. They're sent all around the country. And we're paying for them to stay and support them. We're being destroyed from within. And not just that, but there are many other things. We think of our withdrawal from Afghanistan. We left Americans behind. That was criminal, absolutely, positively criminal, and nothing happens. No consequences. There's maybe some congressional investigations, but no one loses their job. No one gets fired. We have our general, Mark Milley, calling China, talking to his Chinese counterpart, their general from China, tell him, oh, if Trump were to try to do something, you know, I'd be there to warn you and all this other stuff. Crazy. And then when we think of the issues about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I saw a little bit of their interview And they were, you know, representatives asking Milley, what did you tell President Biden exactly? Did you say you should leave 2,500 people there? Well, that's confidential, and I don't normally speak about what's confidential between me and the president. Oh, but there are three books out, and in these three books, you're relating what you talked to Trump about this and Trump about that. So is there a difference? You know, you can, oh, I've never read those books. I don't know what's in those books. And absolute, absolute bizarre, crazy. And, you know, we're being betrayed from within. Economically, our economy is being destroyed. We were once energy independent. We were the biggest producers of energy in the world. And now it's completely opposite. We're dependent on other countries. And we're once again vulnerable. You know, it's interesting how much we get from China, especially when it comes to pharmaceutical and medicines and such like that. I think 70-80% of that. They could blackmail us just on that front alone. But this did not happen overnight. And the more you see and the more you hear, you realize how deep have been embedded these people that want to bring the destruction of the United States. I mean, it seems like it's in all areas. And it makes us angry. Like, I see people that are very angry that they know they're being lied to. This is not the truth. They're being told things that are completely false, and they can verify it. But then again, those people who try to speak out, if it's on the internet, they get deplatformed, they get silenced, they get removed, etc. You all know these things. But my point is this. What's happening today that gets us so angry about what's happening in our country, this is what happened in the church during Vatican II. There are so many things that were happening that were red flags that say something is not right. How did we get to this point, or how are these things going on? I have one little article here that I'd like to share with you, and I like to get what I would say neutral sources. So this is a Time magazine, liberal secular magazine, December 12th, 1969. The title of this is Liberating the Greg. Now, the Greg, or the Gregorian Institute, is a Jesuit seminary in Rome. It was founded by St. Ignatius Loyola in 1551, and it produced 33 beatified, 8 saints, 15 popes. Every year, 30 or 40 of its alumni became bishops. Fully two-thirds of the church's seminary professors of theology were educated at the Gregorian Institute. Now, what was done under Paul VI? Well, one of the interesting things, he removed the conservative cardinal and replaced him with this sociologist priest, Canadian-born sociologist Hervé Carrier. What did he do? First year. And Time magazine is, how would you say, they're astonished themselves. He made the seminary co-educated. So he introduced 198 women into the seminary. Not the most intelligent thing, especially if priests take a vow of celibacy, but they didn't stop there. With regard to the discipline, seminarians were no longer to wear the cassocks, and they wore cassocks according to what country. The color of their cassock indicated what country they were from. And after that, he introduced into the theater pornography. They were going to be, quote unquote, enlightened. And then it talks about how they started to have outside professors, Protestant professors coming in to lecture. Protestant professors, they even had a Jewish rabbi come in as well. And you know, by their fruits you shall know them. It wasn't very long before vocations began to drop and things began to change radically within the seminaries. Now, it's interesting, Mount St. Michael's was built, I think, in 1917, and we purchased Mount St. Michael's in 1977, 60 years later. If you look at any of those pictures as you leave the dining room, on the right side, there's pictures of when the Jesuits were here. I was told, and you hear things, but I can't verify it, but there were hundreds of Jesuits here, maybe up to 450 Jesuits at one time. This place was thriving, and it was self-sufficient. By 1977, when we bought this, the Jesuits wanted to get rid of it. It was a white elephant. They didn't need it. It was way too big for what they needed. And in fact, when we were moving in, they were moving out, there's only 20 Jesuits here, a couple priests and a lot of different brothers. 20. It's very, very sad. It makes you sick to think what had happened in that short span of time. And this all, we can point right back to Vatican Council II and the spirit of renewal, of updating. It makes me sick to think when I go back to Chicago, I probably won't go to my old neighborhood anymore because the shootings are so incredibly large. So many people are getting shot every week that I don't want to be a target. So, but I just remember when I went to school, the church and school we went to, we had 500 families going into that church. And we were only 1 mile away from St. Isidore's, a mile away from St. Peter and Paul, a mile and a half away from St. Michael's. I could name parishes just as big all around us. We had 500 families. We had 1,000 kids going in our grade school from second grade to eighth grade, 1,000 kids. What happened in a short span of time? School closed, church closed, it's empty. It's totally, absolutely empty. And so was the other school we went to, St. Peter and Paul. The church is still there, but the school is closed down. These things did not happen by accident. Just like what's happening today all around us is not happening by accident. It's planned, it's calculated, and it's organized. Didn't happen by accident, and the same thing with the change in the church. Did not happen by accident. It was very well planned. Now, many of you have seen this picture before. This is actually right off of the original negative. The photographer, he took this picture right after the commission for the Novus Ordo. Now, fortunately, Father Francis LeBlanc, God rest his soul, from Phoenix, he wrote to this photographer and says, I want that negative. And he got it. So I had asked Father LeBlanc, can I get a picture off that negative? Because then I'll have an exact real, you know, it's not a generation of a generation of a generation, but this is right off the negative. And what you see in the picture there is Paul VI, Montini, with six of the Lutheran ministers, theologians from Taizé, France, who are on the commission to change the Mass. Now, once again, in those times, you see a picture like that, and there should have been red flags. What are Protestants doing on a commission to renew the Mass? But there's even a bigger red flag, and that is when they came out with the Novus Ordo, the new Mass, the definition they gave of the new Mass is very, very telling. The Mass, they said, is the gathering together of the people of God under the priest as a presider, the presiding priest, where two and three are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst. Now let's analyze this definition that's right in the preface of the Novus Ordo. The concept that the priest is a presider, he's like the president, he's like the overseer of the gathering of the people of God. And how is the presence of Christ brought about? By the people of God coming together. Does that have anything to do with the holy sacrifice of the Mass? Absolutely not. The Mass is the renewal of Christ's sacrifice on the cross. The priest acts in the person of Christ, and by his power from the priesthood, he consecrates. He changes the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. The separate consecration signifies the shedding of blood, signifies sacrifice. What's interesting is when Paul VI came out with this Novus Ordo, even the Sacred Congregation of Rites was, where did this come from? Sacred Congregation of Rites, they are the people supposed to be putting these things together and working on these things. No, it was a special commission because they were going to do an end around. But those should have been red flags for everybody. What are these Protestants doing here and how they radically change things? Now, you know what I like to do is I like to hit on definite points because sometimes people say, oh, I don't believe that. I don't believe this. Are you exaggerating? This is right off of the Vatican website. And what it is, it's the guidelines for the admission to the Eucharist between the Chaldean Church, which is an Eastern Catholic Church, and the Assyrian Church of the East, which is schismatic. What is amazing about this, right off the Vatican website, is that this decree is saying Catholics can go to the schismatic mass. And that's not the only problem. Not just that they're outside the church, they're schismatic. The bigger problem is these schismatics do not have a consecration in their mass. The priest does not take the host and says, this is my body or the chalice, this is the chalice of my blood. They don't know any of that. There is no consecration. And yet, John Paul II, and under him at that time was Benedict XVI, Ratzinger said, that is a valid mass. You don't have to be a great theologian or a doctor of the church to know, no consecration at a mass, there is no mass. And I read later on, Cardinal Ratzinger in one of his ramblings in one of his books said this, people get hung up with words and formulas. What's the big deal? That's not important. They forget that what's important is the community. The community. No, the Catholic Church teaches there are three things you need for a sacrament: matter, form, and intention. And when the priest takes the bread and wine, he consecrates, whether there's anybody there or not. I mean, ordinarily, a priest should have a person present, a server, at least one person present. By exception, a priest may have a mass without anybody present, but when he has mass by himself, the consecration takes place because he represents Christ, and he says in the person of Christ, this is my body, this is the chalice of my blood, etc. A problem. Vatican II is now saying the gathering of the people of God with the priest presiding, that brings about the presence of Christ. Now, we could say we're gathered in the name of Christ here, that Christ is spiritually in our midst. But that's a completely different than Christ in the Holy Eucharist, where our Lord is substantially present on the appearance of bread and wine. Another thing I'd like to share with you is this, which is very interesting. One of the popes, I think it was Pope Leo XIII in Satis Cognitum, his encyclical on unity of the church, he says something very fascinating. He said, the most dangerous of heresies are those heresies that admit of almost all the truths of the faith, but like a drop of poison, they pervert and alter the true sense of doctrine and dogma. Now, I find it interesting, as we're talking about the Eucharist, this is the new code of canon law promulgated by John Paul II, 1983. Now, prior to this, the 1917 code of canon law, it was Canon 731, said, it is forbidden for Catholic ministers to administer the sacraments to heretics and schismatics. They must first be reconciled. They must first be reconciled to the church before they be given the sacraments. Now we have here the new code, and it's Canon 844. It says that those who are schismatic, if they need to go to communion, they can be given communion. And that's number three. And number four says that Protestants could go to communion as well. Now, what are the conditions? They have to be in grave need, and that's to be determined by the local bishop what's grave need. They can't get to their own minister, so they're obviously not being reconciled to the church. And what they have to do is they have to exhibit a belief in that sacrament, like the Eucharist. The church never taught this. This is utterly preposterous. But you know, the thing is this. It was very cleverly orchestrated how they went from one thing to another to another to another. John Paul II, in one of his addresses, was talking about this Canon 844. He said, a Eucharistic sharing at a mixed marriage between a Catholic and a Protestant is possible. Possible. And we know when John Paul II died, Cardinal Ratzinger, who was the celebrant at the funeral, supposed mass, gave communion to one of these fellows, one of these Lutheran fellows that was pictured in this picture here back in 1969. And it's interesting because with regard to everything that's going on, you use an accumulative argument. You start putting this together, that together. What is going on? Now, I'd like to say one thing about the Lutherans, and that is that they celebrated Luther's break from the Catholic Church back in 1517. They celebrated in 2017. So from 1517 to 2017. It was the 500th anniversary of Luther's break. And what did Francis do on this occasion? They erected a statue in honor of Luther. He went to the Lutheran church somewhere, I think it was in Sweden, to celebrate with them. And they had a stamp made in honor of Luther. And it said, "Witness to the Gospel." The Vatican put out a stamp in his honor. How in the world can the man who says he's the Pope and Vicar of Christ recognize this event as something good and to be celebrated and we to be joyful about? Luther dragged from the church not only the people of his time, but for the last 500 years, how many people have been living under the fraud that all you need to do is believe in Jesus and you're saved? You know, with regard to Luther, he was a fallen away priest. He left the priesthood. He's an apostate. He attacked a church, and he said that I stand and I can't do otherwise. I want to just share with you, just try to comprehend this. Long before Luther broke from the Church of Christ started in 33 AD. So we have popes, ecumenical councils, the Catholic Church is worldwide. And here comes Luther in 1517 saying, "No, you were all wrong for all that time, and now I got it right. This is the way it is. The Mass is not a sacrifice," Luther said. Don't dirty it, he said, with the name sacrifice. He said he didn't believe in transubstantiation. He believed in consubstantiation. The bread and wine don't become the body and blood of Christ like Christ said. No, Christ is present together with the bread and wine. If you have faith, Luther was rewriting theology. This is not the faith that's been handed down. That's the beautiful thing about us as Catholics. We can look back over the last 2,000 years and we know what the church teaches. Whenever the popes have spoken, they always quote from scripture and tradition and the early church. And you have this consistency there. You have this consistency, always teaching the same thing, no contradictions. That's why the church is one. That's one of the marks of the church. Church is one. That's all gone out the window with what's happened since Vatican Council II. I know you've known these things, you've heard of these things, but the problem is this. The time for doubting or having any questions is over. When we look at, and I'm not trying to show you the black and white things, when you look at what's happened since Vatican II, what were the main errors of Vatican II? If somebody were to ask me, what are the main errors of Vatican II? I could say this. Number one was religious indifferentism. The idea that all religions are good and praiseworthy, and it doesn't matter what religion you belong to, as long as you believe in something, you're okay. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And religious differentism is the foundation for false ecumenism. The idea that we should get together with other churches or other religions, all recognize each other and try to join together. Don't try to convert anybody. Let's be respectful. You can believe, you Hindus can believe that you want, and the Buddhists can believe that you want, and the Muslims can believe this way, and everybody else. And supposedly think that this is, we all worship the same God, and that we should promote the good in other religions. Now, that is exactly what Vatican Council II said. The Catholic Church rejects nothing that is good and holy in these other religions. After mentioning the Hindus, the Buddhists, and that said about all the other religions of the world, where does this put the first commandment? "I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before me." It goes right out the window. And that's the reason why when you see the man who calls himself the Pope, I'm sure you've seen his pictures 1,000 times, but he's recognizing his getting this blessing from this Hindu priestess here. You've seen this picture before. These are all old hat. Kissing the Quran. The Quran is the Muslim book. It denies the Trinity, denies the divinity of Christ. He's showing reverence to that. And last but not least, you've seen the many pictures of the Assisi meeting. What all that tells you is this. When you have 150 religions represented at Assisi, it just goes to show that he recognizes the value of their prayers. He called this meeting together. He said, "Come and pray for world peace." And, you know, everybody did their thing. This is absolutely, positively condemned. It's against the first commandment of God. Pope Pius XI condemned us in his encyclical Mortalium Animos. He said, this is tantamount to apostasy, abandoning the religion revealed by God. And now we have Francis not only going so far as the ecumenism's old hat, that's a long time ago. But for those of you who weren't here last year, it's very interesting, but people send me stuff. You know, if it's free, I'll take it, you know, I long have to pay for it. But this is a magazine called The Traditionalist. It is really modern Catholics trying to be conservative. And this is Roger McAfee. So he's put out, I think, the Latin Mass magazines, this and that, whatever else. They have a section on the issue with regard to Amoris Laetitia, the apostolic exhortation of Francis. And what's interesting, they quote, there's at least 40 different theologians here going through a critical study of Amoris Laetitia, and they're accusing him of heresy, blasphemy, contrary to sacred scripture, and on and on and on and on. It's become obvious that Francis is not Catholic. He doesn't have the Catholic faith. He publicly does not have the Catholic faith. This is not rocket science. It's not deep theology. It's very, very basic. He's professing things that have been condemned. He's professing things that are heretical, and it's repeatedly done over and over again, blatantly done. So we get to the next section, what I wanted to cover. We're going through this very quickly. Oh, by the way, just one added thing. Even in the Code of Canon Law, the 1917 Code, it was considered forbidden to actively worship with other religions, other churches. And in fact, the penalty for it was, in this Canon 2314, if you do this, you're considered as under the suspicion of heresy for that very act. But this is where we get to the point, is that where is the Catholic Church today? One of the things we know about the Catholic Church as Christ founded it, and Pope Pius XII tells us this in the encyclical Mystici Corporis, the Catholic Church has got to be visible. It's a visible society, something that we can see and recognize. Now, how do we recognize this visible society founded by Christ? Christ gave the church marks. The Catholic Church is one. It is holy, Catholic, and apostolic. What do we mean by when the Catholic Church, we say the Catholic Church is one? What we say when the Catholic Church is one, we're saying that one in doctrine, one in profession of the faith, one in worship, and one in authority. We have a stark departure from the Catholic faith since Vatican II. Religious indifferentism, false ecumenism, religious liberty. Man supposedly has the right to worship God any way he wants. A new definition of the Mass. The Mass is not a sacrifice, it's more of a meal, like Luther said. And all the other things, and now we have Francis saying that adulterers can go to communion. That was from Amoris Laetitia. This is not one in faith. The Catholic Church is infallible in matters of faith and morals. Faith and morals. With the modern church, you throw out the first commandment, you throw out the sixth commandment, and ninth commandment for that matter. With regard to the Catholic Church being holy, the Catholic Church is holy because it has the means of holiness. It has those ceremonies, those sacraments that were instituted by Christ, the Mass and the sacraments. Now, although Vatican II did not change all of the sacraments, they only had to change a few. And the one I want to dwell on right now, the one would be primarily, I should say two, would be in 1969, obviously they changed the Mass. And in 1968, before that, they changed the consecration of bishops, the form to be used for the consecration of bishops. They render the form ambiguous, which Pope Pius XII said earlier, about 20 years earlier, he said, this is the form, and the sacraments have to express the grace and the power given in that sacrament. This was the very reason why Pope Leo XIII in Apostolici Curiae said the Anglicans, back after Henry VIII broke with the church under Cranmer and under Edward VI. That's why they lost apostolic succession, because they altered the consecration of bishops. They altered the form. Now, what's interesting is this. These are two key areas. Invalidate the consecration of bishops, invalidate the Mass. Why are these critical? They're critical because of the fact that if you stop and think of it, it is through the priest that the presence of Christ on the altar comes about. It's in the Mass. And I find it very interesting that when we look at the prophecies about the Mass, we're running out of space here, just maybe reverse this here for a second. Long before the coming of Christ in Psalm 109, it was said of the Messiah, King David prophesied, he will be a priest. The Messiah will be a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a priest and king who offered bread and wine in sacrifice. We also have Malachias, his prophecy, saying, from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same, my name is holy among the Gentiles, and in every place is offered a clean oblation. Malachias' prophecy about a clean oblation being offered everywhere could never have pertained to the Old Testament sacrifices, because they were not offered everywhere, and they are not offered from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same. They were not continually offered. So the prophecy of Malachias, of the continual sacrifice, pertains to the Mass, and the Catholic Church recognizes that. And in fact, Daniel the prophet actually prophesied that when the continual sacrifice would be taken away, talk about the Mass, the continual sacrifice. Now, when we think about it, just to give a little bit of explanation, I may be going too quickly because I'm running out of time here, but if you stop and think, worldwide, Mass is being offered everywhere because of the time zones. From the rising of the sun to the going down of the same, in every place there's offered Mass. And this was true long before Vatican II. But when Daniel the prophet speaks about the continual sacrifice being taken away, we have St. Alphonsus Liguori, Doctor of the Church. He says in his book on the Holy Eucharist, it is true that before the coming of the Antichrist, at the time of the Antichrist, they'll try to destroy the continual sacrifice. Why? In order to usher in the presence of the Antichrist, the presence of Christ needs to be diminished here on earth. If any of you go into the bookstore, there's the commentaries. There's the Old and New Testament. And it's the commentaries are by Father George Haydock. And in this passage, talking about our Lord, talking about the abomination of desolation, and as spoken of by Daniel the prophet, the footnote says, it is true, in the time of the Antichrist, they will try to destroy the Mass and try to destroy the presence of Christ here on earth and institute new things. So when we think of the Mass being changed and the consecration of bishops being changed, what we're seeing is the presence of Christ being diminished. And unfortunately, as we were saying, these things are old. These things have been going on for, 40, 50 years now? But as we were saying in the sermon, there's no doubt in my mind, the times in which we live are what we call the apostasy. St. Paul, in his letter to the Thessalonians, second letter says, chapter 2, there'll be an apostasy from the faith. There are many other scripture commentators and even theologians that talk about an apostasy. And there's no doubt in my mind, when we see the men that are supposed to be Pope from Rome recognizing other religions and coming out with the things that are so blatantly non-Catholic, not even close to what the Church teaches, like a neon sign, this is not the Catholic Church. So we talk about one holy. Catholic means, obviously, universal. And then lastly, apostolic, having apostolic succession. Can't carry down. Christ, when he commanded his apostles, he said, go teach all nations everything I've commanded you, and I am with you all days, even to the consummation of the world. The apostles were not to live to the end of time, but the apostolic succession was to continue with their successors. So the Pope, his successor, he's a successor of St. Peter. The bishops are successors to the apostles. And Vatican Council I said there will be pastors and teachers in the church to the end of time because Christ promised to his apostles and their successors, I am with you all days, even to the consummation of the world. Like I say, we're in very, I would say, very dire times for sure. And as we were saying in the sermon, things are happening very, very rapidly, very quickly. But the important thing for us to do is do this and never forget. It's not like Christ has abandoned us. It's not like Christ has not provided for us. I remember in the 1960s, we used to have to drive all the way to the north part of Chicago, go to Mass. And I was thinking in my back of my mind, if this old priest dies, where are we going to go? I mean, where do you go? And it seemed pretty bleak because the Novus Ordo was everywhere and everyone seemed to be going along with it. But somehow, by the grace of God, there were priests that recognized what was going on. Not just priests, but also bishops are recognizing what's going on is not Catholic. We're going to stay traditional. And that is where I believe the Catholic Church is today. The Catholic Church is going to be visible because Christ established it as a visible society. And it's going to be where the Catholic faith is professed whole and entire and where there are valid bishops and there's valid priests and there's valid sacraments and where there's faithful. And the bottom line is that you should not doubt that or question that. Now, the big issue today comes to the papacy, and I want to just cover this. We're running out of time, but the papacy is the key issue. What's interesting, when we read, and we mentioned this in a sermon, when we read of St. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, it talks about the apostasy and a man of sin sitting in the temple of God. St. Paul says, the mystery of iniquity is already at work, provided only that he who at present restrains till he'd gotten out of the way, then the wicked one will be revealed. Who is the one that has restrained the mystery of iniquity down through the centuries? Obviously the Pope. He is Christ's representative. He has supreme authority within the church. He is gifted with infallibility to teach without the ability of error on matters of faith and morals. It's a matter of the papacy. And I like to just keep this very, very simple, but we have to remember this. It's a matter of divine law. Divine law forbids heretics and schismatics from being elected to the papacy. Divine law forbids that. Also, even if a man were a pope, the pope is not impeccable. He can commit sin. He's capable of committing sin. In fact, there was like three or four sinful popes before. But the bottom line is that was in their own personal life. But when they came to speak on as representing Christ, they were protected. But the Pope can commit sin. And theologians say if the Pope were to commit the sin of heresy, if he were to fall into heresy, public heresy, he would cease to be Pope. Now, that's not just my opinion. That is the teaching of Pope Innocent III. With regard to heretics, schismatics, and those who fall away from the faith not being able to be elected to the papacy, that's Pope Paul IV, and canon lawyers and doctors of the church. The idea of the sin of heresy and being deprived of the papacy, this is something that was taught by St. Robert Bellarmine, St. Antoninus, St. Francis de Sales, many, many theologians and canon lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. Why? It's divine law. How do you know someone's a member of the church? They're baptized, and they profess the Catholic faith whole and entire. Now, we've given these lectures before. We've talked about it many times. I'm sure that you are probably like, oh, yeah, whatever. One article I neglected to tell you is this. Father Francisco Radecki sent this to me. I thought, hey, this is pretty good. 1999, this is John Paul II giving a public catechesis, September 9th, and this was printed in 1999. He gave it in 1998, and he's talking about the seeds of truth in world religions. And I like to show this to people because I say, is this the language of a true pope? In Nostra Aetate, which is the Declaration of the Vatican II on relations of the church to non-Christian religions, Second Vatican Council teaches that the Catholic Church rejects nothing what is true and holy in these religions. She has a high regard for the manner of in life and conduct, precepts and doctrines, which although differing in many ways from her own teaching, nevertheless often reflect a ray of that truth that enlightens all men. Now he goes on to say, I'm just reading excerpts from it, it must be kept in mind that every quest of the human spirit for truth and goodness and last analysis for God is inspired by the Holy Spirit. The various religions arose precisely from this primordial human openness to God. At their origins, we often find founders who, with the help of God's Spirit, achieved deeper religious experience, handed on to others this experience, and it took the form of doctrines, rites, precepts of the various religions. And he goes on to say, this is the wonderful experience we had at Assisi, where all the religions of the world came together and worshiped according to their own way. And he goes on to say, the Holy Spirit is not only present in other religions, the Holy Spirit's presence and activity affect not only individuals, but also society, history, peoples, cultures, and religions. That's the reason why John Paul II could say he recognizes all these religions because he sincerely believes that the Holy Spirit has guided all of them. Now, I'll give you a short catechism on that. What's wrong with that? God himself has revealed through Jesus Christ the one true religion. The Catholic faith founded by Christ, Christ was the only person in the history of the world who has done what he has done to show his divine nature and mission. Christ fulfilled prophecies. He worked miracles. This is the religion revealed by God, and God has given us the divine proof, miracles and prophecies. The other religions are man-made. They do not have supernatural proof. And if God had so sent his Son into the world to reveal the true religion and work miracles and prophecies, supernatural events to prove the divine nature and mission of this church, this religion, how does it make any sense that anybody could just come up with their own religion and that man-made religion is going to be good, better, or just as good as the one that was revealed by God? Utterly bizarre. That's the reason why the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before me. It's a matter of the first commandment, and that's where we have to just keep it simple. So I know we're talking to the choir. I know you've heard these things before, but we should not doubt the reality that this is the apostasy. Those men in Rome are false popes. They have no claim, title to anything. Now, it's interesting that when we think of this, this is what really actually divides the traditionalists today. The traditionalists have, obviously, different views about the papacy. And we have been accused of saying, well, you don't believe in the pope. That's not the case at all. It's because we believe in the papacy that we recognize these men, there's no way these men can be pope. Now, we'll just give you a couple of examples, but the one thing for sure is this, with regard to the concept of the papacy, Vatican Council I in 1870, under Pope Pius IX, they said, the authority of the Pope is unsurpassed by anybody. No one is allowed to sit in judgment of its decisions. Now, this is the thing that we should keep in mind. If John Paul II were the Pope, if Francis were the Pope, if Paul VI were the Pope, then we will be obliged to think, believe, and practice things that the Catholic Church has condemned in the past. It's a contradiction. When our Lord said to Peter, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven, when the Pope decrees something, it's not for us to just take it or leave it. If he's the Pope, it's going to be bound in heaven what he decrees. Now, obviously, we have popes and councils of the church teaching for nearly 2,000 years. Then all of a sudden, Vatican II comes along and just throws it out the window saying, no, this, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do that. We have the Canon 731 under Pope Benedict XV, 1917 code saying it's forbidden to give communion to Protestants, heretics. Vatican II, John Paul II, new code, 1983, give them communion. We have the Catholic Church condemning the idea of worshiping with other religions. That's Canon 1258, the 1917 code. And we have Vatican II authorizing it, encouraging it, and practicing it blatantly. So if he were the Pope, if Francis and John Paul II and all these others were Pope, and they're contradicting divine law, they can't be the Pope. There's an impossibility there. But there are some who, we call them, recognize and resist. They say, well, he's the Pope, but we have to resist him. We don't follow him. That's not the papacy that Christ established, not the Catholic Church that Christ established. Then everybody becomes a Pope. Well, I don't like that. Well, I don't like this. I'll take this. I'll take that. I'll become the Pope and decide what I'm going to accept from the Pope and what I'm not going to accept from the Pope. That's bizarre. It's crazy and completely contrary to what Christ has established. So the idea of the papacy, this is the dividing point amongst traditional Catholics. But I tell you this, I find it very interesting. Many of these people can recognize, and that's the sad thing, they can recognize the errors coming from the modern church, like these 40 theologians who are accusing Francis I, Amoris Laetitia's apostolic exhortation, they're accusing of heresy. But then they say, well, you know, we can't judge him, you know, on just one document. And, you know, maybe somebody else wrote and he put his name to it. And maybe he doesn't know what's going on. And they come up with all these different excuses and reasons why they're not going to accuse him of heresy. They're going to accuse him of heresy, but they say he's not a heretic. Very, very contradictory. They can see it, but they're not willing to bring it to its proper conclusion. We have, especially the Society of St. Pius X. Society of St. Pius X had gone through a little bit of a split. The four bishops were consecrated. Bishop Williamson broke with the other three bishops, started consecrating his own bishops. He's the resistance. What do you see with the Society of St. Pius X? You see two aspects of what Archbishop Lefebvre would teach. Archbishop Lefebvre would be a hardliner sometimes to his people, tell them the conciliar church is not the Catholic Church, it's schismatic, it's heretical, etc., etc. And on the other hand, I'm not going to tolerate people that say he's not the Pope. So he'd be going this way and be going that way. And you have reflected Williamson in one group, and Fillet and whoever their new superior general is in another group, two different aspects of what Archbishop Fillet was going to say. But the contradiction is the papacy. How do you reconcile the fact that if you say he's the Pope, the vicar of Christ, and what he binds under is bound in heaven, but you're going to sit in judgment of him and say, well, I'm not going to accept this, and I'm not going to say that, but he's still the Pope, a contradiction. There was an interesting interview by Bishop Fillet with some British reporter, and he went very methodically. He said, Bishop Fillet, do you believe in a papacy? I believe in a papacy. Do you believe he's the vicar of Christ? I believe he's the vicar of Christ. Do you believe that he is the supreme head of the church? I believe he's the supreme head of the church. In your constitutions of the Society of St. Pius X, you say that you owe him reverence and obedience. Rest. Yes, I do. Then why were you consecrated without his permission? Why did you get consecrated? He did not give you permission. In fact, you were forbidden. And they resumed the camera in on Bishop Fillet, and he's like, you know, whoa, you know, he's coming out. I mean, he's stuck. He's stuck because he knows he's in a contradiction. Whether he wants to admit it or not, he's in a contradiction. Because the bottom line is that if these men are Pope, you have no authority to establish churches and chapels and things all around the world and completely disregard him. That's not the Catholic faith. That's not the Catholic Church. But it gets to this, as we were talking about in the beginning of this short lecture. Just as we see our government being infiltrated and our country being destroyed from within, that's exactly what happened in the Catholic Church. This is nothing new. The Masons said for years they would try to destroy the Catholic Church from within. The Alta Vendita was a Masonic plan to infiltrate, get men within the highest rankings of the church, even within the papacy, and to destroy the church from within. This is what we see happening. So we shouldn't doubt, we shouldn't think, maybe there might be, you know, maybe that is the church, or maybe he's the Pope, or maybe this is, no, there's no doubt about it. It's very, very black and white. And that's why we try to use, like I say, just a few examples of many to bring that contrast out. And we shouldn't look, we should not look to these men for the solution. Besides the set of Econtists who say there's no Pope, and besides St. Pius X who say, well, he is the Pope, we just have to disobey him. There's some who have adopted what they call a material Pope theory. And that is that these men have been validly elected, but because of their erroneous or their heretical teachings or beliefs, God has not given them the authority. So somehow they're in between. They're elected, but they don't have the authority. I read something very interesting in the canon law book by Abel and Hanen, and these two canon lawyers were saying, what is necessary for the validity of election? He has to be a baptized Catholic male, have the use of reason, and he has to be capable of receiving and exercising the jurisdiction attached to the office. So you can't have, well, he's part the Pope, but part not the Pope. He's enough of a Pope where he can appoint bishops, make cardinals, and he's considered a successor of St. Peter, but he's not enough of a Pope that he can speak infallibly. I mean, this is not the what we would say the church that Christ founded. The church of Christ is visible. The church of Christ is recognizable. Is that conciliar Vatican II church, the Catholic Church? Absolutely not. These men are public heretics. I'd like to just give you one little short blip here, and that is from Pope Paul IV. This is in 1559. He said, if ever it should appear that any bishop or cardinal of the Roman Church or a legate or even the Roman pontiff, prior to his promotion as cardinal or prior to his election as the Roman pontiff, has beforehand deviated from the Catholic faith or fallen to any heresy, we enact, decree, determine, define such promotion or election, even in and of itself, even with the agreement and unanimous consent of all the cardinals, should be null, legally invalid, and void. Nor shall it become possible for such a promotion election to be deemed valid or be valid through reception of office, consecration, subsequent amendation, or possession. And it says, such promotion election, even through the lapse of time, shall not, in the foregoing situation, be considered even partially legitimate in any way. Those promoted or elected by that very fact and without the need for any further declaration shall be deprived of dignity, position, honor, title, authority, and power and office. Now, what's interesting, we've talked about this before, on the backside is very small print, but this is the text of the Code of Canon Law 1917. And this decree of Pope Paul IV is referenced in the Code of Canon Law. In the footnotes tell you the references for these canons. And one canon says that you automatically, without a declaration, lose your position of the church, and it's Canon 8, 188, number 4. Number 4 is, if you publicly defect from the faith. You publicly defect from the faith, you have tacitly resigned your office. You don't have any position of the church without a declaration. It's already done. So I find it interesting. There are some who say, well, he's materially the Pope, and this is what their solution is. They say the only way the church can be straightened out is if these false popes, what they call material popes, if they recognize their error, they profess the Catholic faith, then they become totally pope. But until then, there's nothing we can do about it. Or it could be that one of these Novus Ordo bishops gives a warning to these false popes and warns them, and then he's not the pope, and then the church can solve it that way. That was the position of Bishop Gerard de Lauriers, the material pope theory, et cetera, et cetera. And for myself, we've argued much in a time with Bishop McKenna back in the 80s about this. How could this be? A man's part pope, part not the pope. He's validly elected, but he doesn't have any authority. He can appoint cardinals and bishops, but he can't speak infallibly. How do you come up with this? Where does this come from? This is not the language of the church. The church's language is this: public heretics cannot be elected to the papacy, and if a pope were to become a public heretic by the personal sin of heresy, he would lose his position within the church. So there are many, many things going on or out there amongst the traditionalists. You get on the internet, there's so many different opinions, etc. But the important thing is this: we have to stick with what the Catholic Church has taught. We have a little pamphlet that we put together, Objections, Answering the Objections to the State of the Country's Position. The whole book is just quotes from the popes, canon lawyers, theologians, doctors of the church on this very topic. If any of you would be interested in a copy of that, they might have it at the center. If not, we can send you one. But I think it's important. What does the church teach? If that's what the church teaches, that's what I believe. Now, we only have about 5 minutes. I know we're starting late, and we had the pontifical mass, and then we had the final vow ceremony. We had confirmations. I was teasing Father Casimir. I said, we've done everything. Which let's elect a pope. Just joking. You know why that would be absolutely wrong? Because theologians say, in the absence of cardinals, or if there's doubt who the true cardinals are, it's the universal church that would have to elect a pope. And these false popes, and there are a lot of them out there. We have one just south of Nebraska and Kansas, Michael I, who got elected with himself and four other people. It's sad. Very, very, it's ridiculous. It's sad. And I'm not advocating anything of the sort. We were just joking about that. But the point is this: we live in very confusing times, and people do things that are rash, and they cause more confusion to the situation already existing. And what we need to do is to persevere in the faith, and not only that, but also try to achieve a unity amongst all Catholics, for us to try to help each other out. The mystical body of Christ needs to work together. Are there different opinions out there? Yes. Some people don't see it this way or that way, but the bottom line is that the Catholic Church, instituted by Christ, is going to last to the end of time, and we want to be persevering in that one true church. I wanted to open it up to any questions. We only have like 5 minutes before I have to say the Angelus. I know I talk fast because we're kind of pressured for the time, but I just wanted to cover this as succinctly as possible. Any questions? Yes. Okay, we'll clarify the Una Cum Mass. Okay, those priests, validly ordained priests that offer the Mass Una Cum, that means one with Francis or John Paul II, etc. This is the issue. There's a difference of opinion. Some priests say it's a mortal sin to go to that Mass. And I'll tell you for a couple reasons why I don't hold that position. And this was not just my opinion, but it was the opinion of, when I was ordained, the older priests and bishops at that time. None of them ever held that position, whether it was Bishop McKenna or Bishop Musey or Bishop Carmona, Bishop Gerard de Laurier. There were older priests that didn't hold that position, that it's a mortal sin if they mention these men in the canon. Now, this is my opinion. I believe that those who recognize these men as pope, they're mistaken. They're mistaken about this aspect that he's a pope. Some of these priests that you may talk to, they may say, well, you know, I don't know, maybe he is, I don't know. But, you know, nothing's been declared officially, so I'll just throw his name in. And they're still professing the Catholic faith. They're still validly ordained. But does it make their Mass a mortal sin for you to attend? What does canon law says? Canon, I think it's 2261 says, the Catholic faithful can petition the sacraments from someone even who's been excommunicated as long as it's not been declared. Now, why does the church have that canon? Because the church is, you know, wanting the faithful to have access to the sacraments as much as possible. The sacraments are for our salvation. They're for our salvation. And I'd have to say this too. that at what point did it all of a sudden become a mortal sin? No one was saying this in the 1960s. No one was saying in the 1970s. No one was saying this in the 1980s. Maybe late 90s, there were some priests who were saying, oh, I think it's a mortal sin if you add his name to the canon because he's not a true pope and you're uniting yourself with this false pope. Has it become a mortal sin because they said so, or is it a mortal sin because intrinsically that's the way it was from the beginning? So if you, for myself, you know, if people have nowhere else to go, they have no other place for the Mass and sacraments, and they need to go to a priest who offers Mass unicum, I mean, that's on them. They can have they have the right to the position of sacraments. However, I would have this caveat, this warning, that if you have children and they're hearing from the Pope, well, we ought to pray for the Pope so that he comes back to the faith, and we ought to pray for his conversion, and stuff like that, that's confusing them. And I think with Pius X, more and more I hear of them compromising in different areas of accepting things that are Novus Ordo, whether it's the communion fast or no, you can eat meat on Friday or not observing the Lenten fast or whatever else. They compromise in those things. That can be very confusing to children. So I think there was a Father Martin Stepanich. How many of you have heard of Father Martin Stepanich? He wrote a big, long article on this that with regard to the unicum issue. He said, if you're going to try to say that it's a mortal sin to go to always go to these unicum masses, he said, and you're going to try to quote from theologians or, you know, past teachings, it's you that's making it up because you're not going to find the situation as we have it today. Okay, what I like to do is just say this. I think what you have to do is take the wind out of their sail against the state of a contest. And the first thing you have to say is, when I'm talking to somebody, I say, listen, I believe in the papacy. I believe in popes. I wouldn't be Catholic if I didn't believe in the papacy. But I find a serious contradiction between what popes have taught before Vatican II and after. And these men that have taught after are contradicting what the popes have taught before them. And they're not only doing that, but they're teaching things that are explicitly condemned. Explicitly condemned. And you can't have it both ways. And so I would just say, take the wind out of the sail and say, we believe in the papacy. And we're just Roman Catholics. We're not some sect or group or whatever. We didn't just pop out of nowhere. There were bishops and priests who, after Vatican II, did not go along with the changes, and that's where we came from. I mean, we just all of a sudden arrive on the scene. No, there were priests that were offering the Mass, and there were bishops offering confirmation and holy orders, etc., and that's where we came from. There's valid orders there. We're not non-Catholics or Roman Catholics. We're just not Novus Ordo. Yes. Well, you don't always have to have a pope. The office will always exist as Christ established it, but there's not always been an occupant in that position. And like I say, to answer that question, I'm going to go through very briefly here some points here. During the time of the Western Schism, when there were three men claiming to be pope, and that was from 1378 to 1417, it was all a matter of politics. But basically, it was at the time when many of the popes were French, and they were making French cardinals. St. Catherine of Siena asked the pope to leave Avignon and come back to Rome. He came back, he died. During the conclave, the Italians were yelling outside the conclave, elect an Italian. So they elected an Italian. He was Pope Urban VI. And within that month, he started to discipline the cardinals. Well, the cardinals said, well, hey, we don't like this discipline. And, you know, as a matter of fact, we were under duress. This election wasn't even valid. Well, they recognized him as pope for at least a month. The cardinals left and went up to Avignon and elected a Clement, another pope. There being two popes lasted for 20 years. And after 20 years, there are some that are saying, this is ridiculous. Man in Rome, man in Avignon. They went to Pisa and elected a third man pope. Now there's nearly, you know, 40 years of three men being pope, and what they said, this is impossible situation. So they either have to step down or resign. Then they weren't sure, well, who the true cardinals were. So added to the cardinals, they had come up with the idea, we need to have delegates from each country so it's balanced. Not going to overload it with French cardinals or Italians. No, the delegates are going to all have to be balanced, and both the cardinals remaining, who they were not sure who was true cardinals or not, but the cardinals remaining, plus the delegates, would all have to elect the same man, which they did, Martin V. That was in 1417. But what do theologians say about the Western Schism? Even if none of them were pope, because there were doubts about things, it's not against the promise of Christ that even for 40 years there could be a period of time which there was no pope. Now, what's interesting, too, is this. That's not just on the Western Schism, but there was a time in which there were three men. There was a time in which there were 3 years in which there was no pope. And during that period of time, there were 21 bishops who had died. There were empty, vacant sees in these dioceses. The neighboring bishops consecrated a bishop for those dioceses, so they wouldn't be vacant for those 3 years. When the pope, it was Blessed Gregory X, got elected, he had no problem with what they did. So that was valid, that was listed, that was lawful. Those bishops functioned in those areas, you know, as bishops. Obviously, their jurisdiction would have been supplied by the church. But the bottom line is this. You know, we're in unprecedented times, sure, but the idea of what we're doing is not unprecedented. Like the consecration of bishops when there's no pope, that's already been done in the history of the church. The idea that there could have been 40 years of no pope, nowhere does the church say, oh, it can only be this time, it can't be that time. It doesn't say that anywhere, you know? So, but our point is this. What we want to do is to persevere in these times. And what's interesting, Father Sylvester Barry, in his commentary on the Apocalypse, he said the most dangerous times for the church in which there's no pope. And he believes, in commenting on chapter 12 of the Apocalypse, that this is what's actually taking place. There's no pope, and the apostasy is taking place, and it's devastating the church. I mean, Father Sylvester Barry wrote this in 1921, etc. Cardinal Manning, who was at Vatican I, he wrote a book, I think it's called The Pope and the Antichrist. He actually has in the back of the book saying, for Catholics to try to fathom this is very difficult. Now, here's a cardinal who was at Vatican I. He said, saints, scripture commentators, theologians believe that at the end of the world, Rome will become apostate. And he says it right in the book. He says, this might be hard for people to fathom, but he said, this is true. He said, look at Jerusalem. What made Jerusalem the holy city? The presence of Christ. But after they turned on Christ, they crucified him, etc., what happened to Jerusalem? It was destroyed in 70 AD. He said, what happened to Jerusalem will happen to Rome. If Rome become apostate, it will become apostate because it will no longer have Christ's vicar present in Rome. So Cardinal Manning wrote that, I can't remember what year, it was 1860s, etc. But Cardinal Manning was one of the, you know, important cardinals of Vatican I about papal infallibility. Any other questions? Yes. I would have to say this. If you stop and think of religious liberty, the very concept of it is a Masonic principle. I mean, that man is free to worship God any way he wants. That's totally Freemasonic. The idea of ecumenism as well. All religions are good. Freemasons, it doesn't matter what religion you are. You know, that's very, very Masonic. But why is it that when I teach the high school kids in school, I say, you know, why is it that the Masons wanted to destroy the church? Because they look upon the church as being tyrannical, controlling people. You want to liberate people, liberty, equality, fraternity, like the French Revolution. Liberate man. And you know, I want to tell you this. What's happening in our country is really a result of this quote-unquote freedom. Freedom of speech, you know, freedom of religion, all this. We have like an example in Texas. They have these anti-abortion laws where if there's a heartbeat, you can't do an abortion. So what are the Satanists doing? It's a part of our religion. Satanist women will become pregnant and they'll abort their baby as an act of worship of Satan. And that's their religion. So that's going to be challenged in court about, you know, whether they can practice their religion. But, you know, when you don't have God, you don't have the commandments, you don't have the church and divine revelation to guide you, man left to himself with his fallen human nature. That's why we have the craziness in our country of supposed rights for abortion, transgenders, homosexuality, and all the other crazy things that people have a right to do. This is really the cancer that's going to destroy our country is that man has a fallen human nature. And without God, without his grace, this cancer is just going to destroy individually and collectively men in society. That's where we're at right now. And that's why the popes back in the 1700s, 1800s, they were so disturbed how Catholic countries were adopting these Freemasonic principles of liberty and freedom and all this. They could see where that was going to head to. It's going to open up a Pandora's box for evil. And that's really what we see in the world today is evil. There's no other explanation for it. It's evil. And what does Satan want to ultimately do? He wants to destroy souls. And he's doing a very good job at doing that. But the point is that I believe, and we can conclude, but Our Lady, you know, Our Lady said, in the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph. Her heart's going to triumph because Satan tried to destroy the Church of Christ, and through her intercession and her protection, the gates of hell did not prevail. The battle is between Satan and the woman. And the woman will crush the head of Satan, but Satan's tried his utmost to destroy the church, destroy souls, destroy Christianity. The very fact that we're together here today, we have traditional Catholics from all around the country, is a wonderful testimony of Our Lady. And it's not just here, but everywhere around the world. You don't know the happiness and joy I have, not in traveling. Traveling kind of, you know, burns you out. But the idea that the Catholic faith is still alive wherever you go. When we were with Father Borja and we went to France and Germany and Italy, I mean, Catholics just like you trying to persevere in the faith. And it's interesting, sometimes you get in contact with people that you never even knew were there in other parts of the world. You see God's grace working. I want to share one story with you. I think we told it to you last year. Father Krisoff, our priest who was in Moscow, he talked about he had been in contact with somebody from the Ukraine. And this young man wanted him to come to the Ukraine for Mass. He had a group of people there. And so Father Krisoff asked him, he said, well, I would like for you to come first to Moscow and meet with me so I can kind of see who you are and get to know you and this and that. Because there's a kind of a tension between the Ukraine and Russia, obviously. The young man said, well, I can't do that. He said, why? Are you working? He says, no, I'm in school. What university do you go to? I'm not in university. I'm in high school. This kid was 16 years old, and he and about 15 or 20 other young people, they get together and they pray the rosary. This kid's not even baptized. Not even baptized, and he has a knowledge of what's going on. That, to me, is remarkable. Now, I'm going to tell you this, too. You know, I get emails from everybody all over the world. But I got an email from this man from Iran. I won't say his name. But he says, I have abandoned Islam for a long time. I see the fallacies. I see the evil of Islam. And I've studied Christianity. I believe in Christ. And in my studies, I know that there is only one Christianity that can truly be, you know, traced back to Christ, and that's the Catholic Church. And I know that there have been many evil things happening in the Catholic Church. He says, how can I become Catholic? Traditional Catholic. So, I mean, there are interesting stories of people that you think are in such remote places and areas, how they can come to a knowledge of the truth. Why? Because the Catholic Church is visible and is still recognizable, and people can still find it. It's still there, despite everything that we've all talked about, you know, last 50, 60 years. But no, what you're saying about the Masonry, absolutely true. And not only that, you can throw in the communists too. But I would have to say this too, you know, as times get progressively worse, I believe that traditional Catholics and probably Christians in general are the ones that are going to be further and further censured and persecuted, and they're going to do it legally. You can't do this. You can't do there. You can't do this. I can see it. And I can see with especially this present administration under Biden, you have to recognize homosexual unions. You can't discriminate against transgenders, et cetera, et cetera. You'll lose your tax exemption. I could see those as very, very real possibilities, you know, to try to force the church to accept this liberalism, you know. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll say the Angelus. Well, basically, it's like this. You know, it's what we call the hylomorphic theory of matter and form. So When it comes to the papacy, what is the role of the cardinals? The cardinals pick the man. God gives the authority, the form. So the cardinals don't give the authority to the Pope. Christ gives that. The authority comes from Christ to the Pope. What are the cardinals' role? The cardinals designate the man who God is going to give the authority to. Okay? So with the material pope thing, they're saying these cardinals have legally elected this man, but because of his false beliefs, God has not given him the authority. But there's a little bit of a problem there. I'm going to go on to just touch upon this real briefly. I can quote it right from Vatican I. Whoever succeeds Peter in this chair holds the primacy. That means the papal authority. So I'm going to give you a real quick lesson in hypothetical syllogisms, okay? Not going to go over your head and keep it real simple. In a hypothetical, you have a condition, and if the condition is met, then you have what follows, the consequent. So I could say this. If it rains, the ground is wet. Okay, that's the major premise. In a minor premise that it rains, then the consequence is follows, the ground is wet. The other way of hypothetical works is you can deny this. If it rains, the ground is wet. The ground is not wet. It did not rain. And I remember 1987, Father Casimir and I went to see Bishop McKenna, and I asked Bishop McKenna, I said, I showed him right out of the book, Vatican I, 1870 says, whoever succeeds Peter in his chair holds the primacy. That's the major premise. If you're saying he succeeds Peter, you have to have he holds the primacy. It's just the way it is. You can't have one without the other. And the other thing is this, like we mentioned at Abel Hanan, the canon lawyers, they said, to be validly elected, he has to be capable of receiving the jurisdiction and exercising the jurisdiction attached to the office. And they would obviously, they'd have to deny that because they say he has no authority. So he's been elected, the material pope theory is, he's elected and he's a successor of Peter, but he has no authority. And this perpetuates itself. Keeps going and going and going and going. But you know, Father Amirhanbovich, he's very familiar with this position. He's talked to the priests in Europe that hold that position, and he said he doesn't believe that even Bishop Garrard or Lerier today would hold that position with the way things have transpired. So, and the other thing too is this. What I've read in theology with regard to like the schismatics, the Greek Orthodox, they have valid bishops, but they're outside the church. So theologians say materially, because they're valid bishops, they have apostolic successions materially, but because they're outside the church, they do not have it formally. But when we think of all of this here, we have a hierarchy where many of these Novus Ordo bishops aren't even validly or consecrated. They're not even bishops. They don't even have anything materially. But that's another aspect. We're talking about apostolic succession, not the papacy. So I know it might seem like it's complicated, et cetera, but it's one of those things where there's opinions out there and it's not my opinion. And I'm not going to condemn somebody if they're traditional Catholic and they reject Vatican II and they think, well, he's materially pope. He has no authority. I don't think so. And I don't think we have to look. You want to wait for Francis to abjure his error and become a Catholic again. Don't hold your breath on that one. And not only him, but any of the Novus Ordo bishops going to warn him and depose him. That's just, it's not going to happen. That's not the language of canon lawyers and theologians. They say he deposes himself. Once he becomes notoriously, publicly a heretic, he is deposed by God. I hope there's no more questions. But if there are one more, I'd take one more.